from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the gun control debate remains center stage after last month's school shooting in Florida. The NRA now says President Trump is retreating from his comments supporting gun control. We'll take a look at all the developments in the debate with our in-studio analysts. Plus, a man who's trying to change the world one tattoo at a time.
I have to believe that people are able to change, because if you're saying no one has the free will to be able to change their thought process, what kind of a world are we living in, and what kind of a world will we have?
And exploring the hidden themes in the music of Star Wars.
Film composers are nothing if not master manipulators. They know tricks that have been well exploited over decades and sometimes even centuries to evoke certain emotional responses.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The gun control debate is shifting today, with President Trump now appearing to be retreating from the comments that he made Wednesday. That was when the president seemed open to proposals such as restricting gun sales to those under 21, seizing guns from those with mental illness, and implementing stronger background checks.
They have to be strong. The background checks, hey, look, I'm the biggest fan of the Second Amendment. Many of you are. I'm a big fan of the NRA, but I had lunch with them, with Wayne and Chris and David, on Sunday, and said, it's time. We got to stop this nonsense. It's time.
But then, on Twitter last night, a top NRA lobbyist said the president was backing away from stricter gun control measures. And today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters that Trump promised the NRA that he would, quote, continue to support the Second Amendment. Well, gun control is the first topic we're taking up with our Week in Review panelists today. With me in studio this week, Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Deb.
Also with us is Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Hi there, Ed.
Hi, good to be back.
So let's talk about, where we're seeing this conversation on gun control shift and what it means. Renee.
You know, I think the important thing is when the president had that bipartisan meeting, it felt to me almost like a kind of flashback to him sitting in the boardroom at The Apprentice. It felt like a performance. Mm. So anybody who heard that and thought, oh my God, he's really shifting his stance on gun control, was really missing the point. What the president says and what he eventually does are two vastly different things. And I think people should have figured that out by now.
Mm. So when you heard those promises Wednesday, you were like, this is meaningless.
I did. I was never convinced.
You didn't think?
You know, there's so many things that could have been done. We're already 2 weeks past the Parkland shooting, and nothing's been done. He kept talking about bump stocks. Has he done anything about bump stocks? So, you know, all these ideas about, well, you know, we can confiscate the guns and we need gun control. It was all for show. The cameras were there, and it was a performance.
Ed, your thoughts?
I think guns are a very serious problem. I think, like opiates, that it will require years of advocacy and policy solutions. I don't think it's really about what anyone says at a given moment. I think that we will need to see Congress do a lot of things. I think that's much more important than what the President of the United States is saying and doing. I don't think the Congress has had a change of heart about this issue. And if the congressional Republicans don't want to do anything in response to these problems, I don't think it matters what the president says.
Hmm. Go ahead.
I do think the president can set the tone, and I think the president can express a serious intent to do something about guns in this country. I don't think he's going to do that. So, you know, there's no one pushing Congress to do anything differently.
No.
No. Okay. Well, we understand that. But so what's happening is that folks and corporations seem to be taking this debate into their own hands to a certain degree, either people pressuring companies or companies themselves. We've heard a lot about that this week as well. We heard the CEO of Dick's Sporting Goods. We heard him on Good Morning America this week, Ed Stack. He said they're going to end sales of assault rifles. Let's listen.
Based on what's happened and looking at those kids and those parents, it moved us all unimaginably, and to think about the loss and the grief that those kids and those parents had, we said, we need to do something, and we're taking these guns out of all of our stores.
And so Dick's was just one company. We also heard from Kroger Company, the largest supermarket chain in the U.S., tightening gun selling policies. We also heard about L.L. Bean no longer selling guns to those under 21 at its Freeport, Maine location. So companies are responding, and folks are threatening boycotts to those companies that don't take certain steps. I'm wondering, does this make it difficult for these companies, for politicians? What are your thoughts about this, Renee?
You know, do I think it makes it difficult for politicians? I think only in as much as people keep that story on the front page and keep it on the front burner. It has been gratifying to see a reaction. You know, usually, you know, grief is very paralyzing, but this time there's also been a sense of anger and the need for action. And we haven't really seen that in a lot of these other shootings. You know, we had the Las Vegas shooting last fall, and that faded remarkably, you know, quickly, given the fact that 58 people were murdered. You know, it wasn't a lot going on. So I think, you know, I'm wary of calling this a tipping point, but I do think there's something to be said for this moment and the fact that people believe that they can do more than that has been done.
Right. So Ed, and you know, you both had said, well, you know, the president made a statement. Maybe we shouldn't be holding that up as being, you know, this is exactly what's going to happen in Washington regarding gun control. So is it different right now because of the emotion, because of the deep grief, because of seeing teenagers who are taking matters into their own hands? And some folks find that inspiring. Does that change things?
No.
It doesn't.
You know, what's going to change this? Yes, there'll have to be cultural changes around guns. I think, you know, we have to figure out how to get back to the American gun culture of previous decades. I don't think we should compare ourselves to Iceland and Japan. We should say, how can we get back to the gun culture under Ronald Reagan? I think that people in the 1980s who owned guns wouldn't recognize the NRA today. They wouldn't recognize the kinds of weapons we're buying. They wouldn't recognize our discussion around guns. I think that there is a lot that's wrong. But a lot of what we have to do is legislatively, and I don't see anything that's going to change in Washington. I mean, the House Republicans literally got shot by somebody, and they didn't change their minds.
And he supports
Congressman Scalia. You know, Scalise, actually, he nearly died, multiple transfusions.
Right. Right.
He got out, and he wants to make it easier to buy guns.
Right.
Do we really think that NRA contributions gave someone that kind of deathbed conviction about how to handle guns? I don't think there's any point talking to people like him about changing the gun laws. It's not about saving kids' lives. They won't save their own lives.
So do corporations have a responsibility to step up? Do they need to?
Sure. I mean, I think it's great that they're taking this on, but because of our attention deficit media, they could change their minds and start selling these things again a year from now. We'd never hear about it. I think it's great that they're involved. I don't think that's nearly adequate. I can't imagine going back to Sandy Hook and saying, you know, several years from now, we're going to have this big moment where we take away the rental car discounts of the National Rifle Association. They would say to me, you mean you're still failing? So I really don't think we're making progress, and I don't think that either side of this debate that's not working has a really good plan on how to move forward.
You know, as with all progress in this country, it's incremental. And on one hand, it says, well, you know, so NRA members can't get a discount from Hertz. Who cares? But it is something. It is movement. And I do think, look, we didn't even know that these discounts existed, you know, a few weeks ago. So I do think that there is a purpose that social media plays in this, in being really diligent and making these companies accountable and saying, look, we know what you're doing and we have a problem with that and you need to stop.
Unless you're Delta, right? And now, of course, you lose a tax break because of taking this stand. The governor of Georgia today signed into law, you know, a bill that takes away that tax break for Delta
But let's see if there are repercussions for Georgia for doing that, the same way that certain states were being punished when they were going against the transgender community. And, you know, and this company said, well, we're not going to have our convention there, and we're not going to have the All-Star game here and all these different things. You know, there's a lot to be said for what the people can do, and I think we're seeing that right now.
I want to get back to those some of these young voices, because we've been hearing a lot about them, and people are saying that this changes the debate. And locally, there are some young folks who are also taking matters into their own hands. There was a walkout this week in Somerville to push for stronger gun control, and we spoke with some of the students who walked out in Somerville, and this is a little bit of tape from 16-year-old student Amalia Hockman.
We wanted to show that we're willing to risk our academics because we want to feel safe for ourselves, and we want to make sure that our students and peers cross country are safe. Hmm.
So that's one student. You know we have more. We have a national walkout planned on March 14th. We've got protests on the Common at the end of the month. And I know, Ed, you say this doesn't change much, but Renee, do you think it does?
I do. Hmm. You know, I mean, there's always the sense that, well, nobody's paying attention or who cares. But, you know, there were a lot of young people during the civil rights era who put their lives on the line and who were out there and risked getting beaten and getting arrested and losing, you know, being pushed out of their schools because the cause was that important. I think we're seeing that again. You know, there's no abstract with these kids. You know, they survived. They did something that a lot of us will never go through. They ran for their lives and they saw their friends die. And so they're very motivated to see change. And I don't think that they're going to wear down. And we're not just talking about the kids in Parkland. We're talking about millions of school children.
Mm. Do you think we'll see states take action on their own, though?
I mean, I think we already have. I mean, you know, when everyone was waiting for Congress to do something about bump stocks, Massachusetts became the first state to ban them. So I think it's going to become something that starts evolving state by state.
Okay, let's move on to another topic here. Massachusetts State Police. More turmoil in the state police this week. This is prompted by a Boston Globe report yesterday that a trooper apparently has a long history of making vulgar and racist comments online. And the Globe identified this trooper as being Trooper Matthew Sheehan, a trooper who was already on leave while officials looked into his shooting of a man during a police chase last weekend. And Governor Charlie Baker responded to the Boston Globe report yesterday. Let's listen.
If those posts were issued by someone who's a member of the state police, they are clearly a violation of the code of conduct, and he or she should be fired.
Renee, your reaction to this latest controversy in the Massachusetts State Police?
You know, speaking about what's happened with this Officer Sheehan, my first question is, did people at the state police know about these posts prior to the shooting he's now being investigated over? So if they did, then that speaks to, again, another problem going on in the state police. In what way is this tolerated? How was this officer on the street given the attitudes he has about people of color? So it has to come to the fact that he's actually shot someone for some action to be taken and people now be outraged. I just wonder what's going on there right now. I mean, this is certainly the last thing the state police needed, but maybe it's the thing that finally pushes them to get their house in order.
Hmm. Ed, your reaction.
Well, I agree. I think that, we don't often have clarity into how police departments operate. They're often very opaque to us. They have very strong unions. They tend to look after themselves and not talk about what the problems they have with other officers. So whenever something like this happens, we have no idea how serious the problem even is. Hearing that there's this sort of private group where they can talk to each other and say these things, you know, we had no knowledge that a group even existed. So I want to say, like, are you creating environments that enable this to get better, or are you putting things in place to kind of educate these people into not thinking this way, or to move them out if they can't change?
Hmm. Let's put it in context for those folks who may not know some of the background. I'll try to be as brief and simple as possible here. We've had four high-ranking state police officials retire since November amid some other controversies. First, a lawsuit from a trooper alleging that he was forced to change an arrest report for a judge's daughter, Trooper Ryan Sevier. He filed a lawsuit, and actually when he did file, we spoke with his attorney, who's Leonard Keston. And Attorney Keston said that the suit alleges that top state police brass play favorites, and then they punished Trooper Sevier for not going along. Let's listen.
He simply reported what he heard, and now he gets sanctioned because he treated her as he would anybody else, and apparently the colonel wants connected people treated differently.
Okay, the colonel did step down after that. But then recently, another controversy was when a trooper was suspended after it was determined that she had been a co-conspirator in a marijuana trafficking case. So these are significant issues within the state police. What message does that suggest to you, Renee? What do you take from that?
You know, you get the sense there must be some kind of like institutional rot at this point. You know, there's no accountability. There's a lack of transparency. And again, you know, it's the sense that they're just doing whatever they want and that they're not accountable to anyone.
OK. Okay. I wonder, also, the salaries of these troopers are generating a lot of comments. The woman trooper who admitted to money laundering and marijuana dealing, she was with the state police for 4 years, and she was earning more than $150,000 a year. Trooper Sheehan, who was the person who was making the posts online, earned more than $230,000 in 2016. What about these salaries, Ed? I mean, what do you make of those, and what does that say about state police? I know you've talked about the lack of transparency, but do you think that folks will also be looking at salaries in all of these?
Sure. I mean, when public sector salaries are high, it's usually because they have a strong union and a lot of political power. I think that police are very well paid. And when you hear about some of these scandals, it sounds like, wow, they thought they could get away with anything. I can't imagine that you'd be pressure somebody into doing a political favor for someone else and to be so open about it. I find that shocking. I can't imagine that happening any place that I've worked in my life. So you think to yourself, wow, these people thought that they were sort of in an organization where they could do whatever they wanted, and they were being paid an enormous amount of money to behave in this way. That must create a real feeling of self-importance and authority.
It's like, what could possibly go wrong with that scenario, right?
How much of a political liability is this for Charlie Baker? Big one, do you think? Continuing one? Could the state public safety secretary step down, Renee?
It depends. You know, if there's another incident, you know, it also depends on how these current investigations are concluded. You know, it could be a problem for him. I don't think it is yet. And you know, as usual, right now he's saying the right thing. If this trooper did this, he needs to be fired. But, you know, it's something he's going to need to be mindful of.
Ed, your thoughts?
Well, we don't know. I mean, my guess is that these kinds of failures represent something that's been a problem for a very long time. I don't think that this happened when Charlie Baker became governor. I get the feeling that it's going to say, well, for many years, things were run in this way. So if that's the case, I don't think it'll affect him at all. I think you'd have to show that something developed recently or that there were warning signs that his administration was aware of and didn't act upon. But barring those things, I don't think so.
Hmm. Well, let's move on quickly here to the big news this week from Amazon. Amazon says it's going to bring at least 2,000 new jobs to Boston. It's leasing an 18-story building in the Seaport District with the potential to expand into a nearby building in the Seaport District with another 2,000 workers. Now, this, of course, everyone has questions about what this means for Amazon's possible location of its second headquarters. Amazon says that this expansion in the Seaport District is not related to the search for its second headquarters, or HQ2, as we all now seem to call it. Now, that project would employ some 50,000 people, and we know that Boston is one of the 20 finalist cities for HQ2. And Mayor Marty Walsh was asked, so does this new expansion in the Seaport mean that Boston is out of the running for the headquarters? Let's listen.
HQ2 is a completely different arm of the company, and when you think about it, it's, you know, they're looking to do more what's in Seattle as far as the company and the services in the company. So
I wonder, Renee, Amazon is saying that, you know, it wants to bring these employees to the Seaport. Should we be celebrating here, or should we be saying Boston lost the headquarters?
You know, my first thought was, you know, is Boston getting hors d'oeuvres and not the main course? you know, I'm wondering if it's a consolation prize. It's a very good consolation prize, but it's not what the city's really aiming for. So the timing seems a little strange to people. Mm. You know, and it was interesting as this news was breaking, the real estate website Zillow came out with a survey that essentially said Boston's out of the running. And one of the reasons it's out of the running is because it's very expensive to live here, and that other areas like the D.C. metro area and Atlanta might be more favorable to Amazon. So having that, you know, sort of float up at the same time that they announced this, it's a little strange.
Ed, your thoughts?
Well, it feels like it's less likely because one of the reasons why they wanted to build another headquarters is because they had too many eggs in one basket on the West Coast. So I feel like that the more eggs they dump in this basket here, it would seem to violate that. I mean, they already had an office here. They now own the Whole Foods all over the place. Now they're going to add 2,000 people to the Seaport. So it would seem that way. I guess it depends on what their interest is in us. If it's just, you know, a city that has, an airport nearby and all of that, maybe they don't. But if they want us for our ethics and our culture and things that are unique to Boston, maybe they still will come here. But I think at this point, to add even more people to Boston, they have to want what's unique about Boston. They have to come here to say, we need some of Boston's values in order to improve our image. I think if that's not the reason they're coming here, then it would seem to me that this latest move makes that less likely.
That's a lovely parting gift.
That's all. It's the hors d'oeuvre. We're not getting the meal. I hope you're not hungry. But if we look at just what we know about this move to the seaport at this point, this deal, apparently, according to the reports about it, was that Amazon would get $5 million in city tax breaks in exchange for 2,000 jobs created within 25 miles of Boston by 2025. And those tax breaks would double if Amazon creates another 2,000 jobs in that second building, right, in the Seaport District. So 10 million possible total tax breaks for 4,000 jobs. Now, many of us remember, because it wasn't all that long ago, that General Electric in the Seaport got almost 25 million in city tax breaks. It got a total of 145 in city and state, but 25 million in city tax breaks for 800 jobs. 25 million, 800... 10 million, 4,000. I mean, it just seems like a very different scenario here. Can we compare them like that or not, Ed?
No. I think, I mean...
I knew you'd say that.
Well, I don't mean... If it has to be yes or no, I'd say no. I think that these deals are often very different. It depends on what kinds of jobs. It depends on what the site looked like before they developed it. The theory of Boston changes over time. I think that as Boston changes and its needs change, that we make different kinds of deals. I think that even the time passing between the GE deal and the Amazon deal really matters, because the parts of Boston you're looking at have really changed. I mean, the Seaport, you know, a year is like a decade in every other part of the city. So, I mean, imagine that the nerds at the Boston plans had decided that, you know, the Seaport is different than it was for GE, and actually it is. GE actually is part of what made it different.
Are there lessons, though, to be taken from the GE experience?
You know, there should be. You know, the interesting thing about the Amazon deal that we learned about this week is, you know, the people who fume about these things and get upset, this isn't going to make them feel any better. You know, are they comparable? No. But people are going to think they're comparable. So, you know, there is going to be this sense of people sort of scratching their heads and just wondering, is the city being really smart about this? You know, and are they looking out for the people who are here as much as they are the people who might start coming into the city?
Do you think we'll see? Neither of you seem to think we're going to see an Amazon headquarters located in Boston.
I think we might. I think there's a good chance. I just think it's probably a little bit less likely because of this, but I still think that it's possible.
Anything's possible. I don't think it's going to happen, though.
Okay. Well, we have time to end with our hubbubs. Those are the brief stories or events that maybe didn't make it into the headlines this week but would have caught our attention. Renee, do you have a hubbub this week?
Yeah, just want to give a quick shout-out to community activists Bridget Wallace and Carol Now, who are the founders of the startup incubator Skylab, who are transforming an old Victorian in Roxbury into a living space for young women of color pursuing careers in science, tech, engineering, and math.
All right.
So it sounds like a great thing.
Yeah. Ed, do you have a hubbub?
That was wonderful, by the way, Renee. I'm glad I learned about that.
Oh, thank you.
I want to call attention to the Seaport Gondola, a private plan to bring a gondola into the Seaport. I think, by the way, if it were there today, you could go above the floodwaters and get into the Seaport. I think it is a wonderful climate mitigation strategy to put a gondola in the Seaport. All of my transportation nerd friends don't like the gondola because they think it's a distraction from sensible things like BRT and all of that. I'm for all of that, too, but this is all privately funded. And I think it would be a wonderful thing for Boston. I brought it up today just because I think that now it's a serious project in a way that before it was more speculative. But now I think that there's a good chance that they're really going to do it. And if they do it, I'm going to buy a ticket.
All right. Gondola. Maybe Amazon and all of that would help. Well, I have a little one. Reddit. I don't know if you saw this, but Reddit posted a tweet from someone who had said, quote, "Even though the MBTA is still broken and terrible, their new Twitter alerts do an amazing job of informing me specifically of what crappy broken thing I should be mad about at what exact time." So while that's a pretty entertaining tweet, the MBTA responded. How did the MBTA respond? With a like to the tweet. All right, we just want to end with that. Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and WBUR contributor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer, thanks to you as well.
You're welcome.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, a nor'easter is hitting Massachusetts right now. We've got strong winds, heavy rains, and at last count, more than 117,000 people in Massachusetts are without power because of this storm. Joining us to talk about some of the damage is Sarah White. She's a spokeswoman for the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. Hi there, Sarah.
Good afternoon, Deborah.
So what's happening out there? Where are you seeing the worst of it?
Across our entire coastline right now, we're seeing pretty strong winds. Gusts over 70 miles per hour have been recorded in several locations along our coastline, which have caused a number of these power outages, power lines, poles down, et cetera.
Is it as bad as expected?
So far, the forecast seems to be holding true to what was expected from the National Weather Service and others that we've been monitoring. One thing that we are really keen to look forward to, in a way, is what is going to be brought by this midnight high tide, which we've been warned that it could be worse than what we saw earlier today, higher seas potentially in certain locations.
And so at last check, what we saw online was 117,000 customers without power. What's happening in terms of trying to get power restored?
Sure. At this point, all of the major utilities have been coordinating with us here in the State Emergency Operations Center. They have let us know that right now the conditions are such that they have crews assessing, but they're not able to restore power with these types of high winds, so they're going to continue to monitor and assess and make restoration plans as quickly as they possibly can.
Is the National Guard still deployed?
Yes, very much so. The National Guard has been deployed throughout the state, assisting local communities with evacuations, with welfare checks. Throughout all of our coastal communities, we've had a presence of the Guard doing high water rescue vehicles and that sort of activation.
Have any injuries been reported, Sarah?
At this time, I don't have a good sense of specific injuries that have been reported, but that type of information does come through our cities and towns, first responders, and will be fed up through the State Emergency Operations Center as that information comes available.
What are you doing to prepare for this midnight high tide?
Right now, we have our nose down in a planning mode. Basically, the American Red Cross and other agencies are here to help us prepare for any sheltering that might be needed, any additional evacuations that might need to happen, to make sure that residents that either cannot return to their homes or might need to leave their homes have a safe place to go. We're really urging residents to listen to their local officials, and if they're asked to leave their homes, to really listen to that advice. We want people to be safe, and we don't want people to try to ride out the storm in their house if they're asked to leave.
All right. Sarah White, spokeswoman for the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And joining us with the latest weather forecast now, WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein, who is joining us via Skype. Hello there, Dave.
Hello.
So how is it out there?
It's windy and it's wet and it's snowy, depending on where you are. Take your pick. There's a lot going on this afternoon for sure. And the winds continue to, uproot some trees and take down large branches. I think also because we've had so much rain, it's becoming a little bit easier for these trees to be uprooted.
We just heard from Mima about this midnight high tide. What should we expect tonight?
Right. So the high tide this afternoon in Boston was the third highest high tide ever recorded at 14.67 feet. It looks like we'll be at about 14.9 tonight. So it won't be quite as high the way it's forecast now as the January event, but it will be pretty darn close, just a few inches under that. So it's still going to be bad. It's probably not going to be a lot worse than we saw this afternoon, maybe slightly worse in a few places, but that's the theme. It won't be exponentially worse. It won't be exponentially better.
But we should still see coastal flooding, winds, a lot of rain, and depending on where you are, maybe some snow?
Yeah, absolutely. So the coastal flooding event will take place tonight around midnight, but by then the storm will be almost over in terms of what's falling out of the sky. So I expect that the snow to be winding down between about midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. So what will happen is over the next few hours, we'll start to see snow break out around Worcester and then pivot down towards the south. It may actually be on a line from Providence to Taunton that ends up with the most amount of snow in eastern southern New England, also up through the Worcester County area, as the cold air kind of works into the storm, and those areas will have leftover moisture. So what's happening is as the storm's rotating away, the moisture's ending. So let's say it becomes cold enough in, say, Concord, Massachusetts for snow, but the storm's ending there quickly, so they actually get less snow than they would further south because it lasts a little bit longer. So we're looking at anywhere from a coating to a few inches of snow. There could be a couple of places which end up with 4 or 5 inches, even in interior southeastern Massachusetts.
And all winding down by Saturday.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Tomorrow morning when you get up, it'll be cloudy, it'll be breezy, but there won't be any precipitation beyond a few light rain or snow showers occurring. The core of the winds are occurring right now and will continue over the next hour to 2 hours. So by the time we get to 6 o'clock, I think all of our highest wind gusts will be in the books for this particular storm.
All right. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Getting a tattoo is essentially a commitment to an image that will stay on your body forever. But forever can be complicated. WBUR's Erica Lance brings us a story from our Kind World series about people who are grappling with that complication. We want to note that this story depicts racism and violence that may be upsetting to some listeners.
Recently, Dave Enty opened an email with a picture of a tattoo he'll never forget.
It was a portrait of Hitler. And now, I mean, it wasn't just a portrait of Hitler. Like, okay, it's his face on somebody's body. It was Hitler in a field with clouds and the sun and birds. That was nearly a guy's entire back.
Over the past year, Dave Enty and Dave Cutlip have seen lots of tattoos like that. Everything from a Hello Kitty swastika to a Confederate flag with a noose. They don't like looking at them, but it's part of a project that's become central in their lives. Dave Cutlip is a tattoo artist in Brooklyn Park, Maryland, and the whole thing started when a man walked into his shop with a prison gang tattoo on his face. The man wanted to cover the tattoo with a new one.
My wife turned around and looked at me, and she was like, "You can help people." And I basically said to her, "You want me to tattoo for free, don't you?" She actually didn't say anything, but she gave me that look, and I know that look.
That night, Dave's wife, Elizabeth Cutlip, posted on Facebook that anyone with a gang-related or racist tattoo could come and have it covered for free. Messages started pouring in, hundreds by the next morning, from MS-13 to Latin Kings, former skinheads, Klan members. Some had gotten tattoos in prison for protection. They were writing to say they were ashamed of their past. So Dave recruited his friend, Dave Enty, to help him manage the undertaking. Yep, they're both named Dave. Dave Enty goes by Diver Dave because he teaches diving. Diver Dave followed up on the emails, which they started calling redemption requests. He did research to decide how genuine the remorse was in each case. To him, the work was personal.
Being a Jewish person, I find I derive great pleasure out of eradicating the world of swastikas one at a time. You know, a whole section of my family were killed in the Holocaust. And being able to be part of seeing people get over that kind of hatred, especially a hatred that is very much directed at me, it means a lot to me. And I think it's a very important work for us to be doing.
Not everyone thinks this is a good idea. Some were angry that Dave would cover these symbols on people whose racist views might be more than skin deep. Diver Dave says all he can do is trust the vetting that he does.
I have to believe that people are able to change. Because if you're saying no one has the free will to be able to change their thought process, what kind of a world are we living in and what kind of a world will we have?
Change isn't easy. Dave remembers a client who asked for a peace sign tattoo, and he told him a simple peace sign won't cover a swastika. Much like addressing racism, covering a tattoo is more complicated than getting the original. You need texture, lines, and dark shaded areas to make it work. It takes time. And it's painful.
We could also just black them all out, put black squares, but that isn't helping with the rebirth and with the growth.
Instead, Dave designs new tattoos for each client based on who they are becoming, turning gang signs into roses and birds. While Dave works on their skin, people open up and he hears their life stories. Stories like Lou's. Lou had a dark childhood, and early on, he says, he got into drugs of all kinds.
Anything I could get my hands on. At that time, I was just trying to feel numb from the world. I didn't care if I died or anything.
He had a lot of anger and self-hatred. He got into skinhead culture, and he says the people he met helped him get off drugs and made him feel accepted. They also channeled his anger toward people who weren't white. Lou gave himself his first white power tattoo when he was a teenager. But by the time he was 21, he was questioning the group's violence and racism.
I met a couple people when I was by myself of different races and started, you know, they started being friendly with me. And you start to realize not everybody's bad. It doesn't matter what color they are. It's something I don't want to be a part of no more.
So he says he left. He asked us not to use his last name because he's scared of retribution.
I just fell off the face of the map. I kind of, you know, I stopped all social media. I had changed my numbers. I actually moved far away. But I still, for the rest of my life, will be a walking target.
He says leaving the group was hard.
The only group I had was my skinhead friends. So when I got out of that, I had nobody.
6 years later, Lou walked into Dave's shop with 9 tattoos on his body that he says he didn't believe in anymore.
I had a death head on one hand. I had
angry tattoos, not just racist, but violent tattoos.
On my arm, I had the stick figures on my leg. That was skinhead stick figure stopping on a black stick figure.
I wouldn't have liked old Lou.
Lou was nervous, but Dave didn't seem to judge him when they talked. Dave's covered about half of the tattoos so far and sees relief in Lou's eyes each time. He and Diver Dave genuinely believe Lou has changed, that they're getting to know someone who's finding himself. One time, Lou told them how hopeless he felt, that he didn't have friends.
We both were like, we'll be your friend.
I felt like I wasn't alone anymore. Every time I get a tattoo, it's basically putting my life back together, putting me back together. I just get happy over the stupid little things now, instead of getting angry over everything.
I'm going to do it until I can't tattoo no more.
Even though after a year of redemption requests and 65 tattoo cover-ups, the job hasn't gotten easy.
I see this stuff and I go, wow, the world is a darker place than I thought it was. I mean, I didn't realize how much hate was out there. Because I'm seeing it from, I mean, I've got at least one case from every state in the Union and Europe and Asia. I had someone call me from as far away as Nepal. It's hard to say that it hasn't changed me, because it has to have. But it makes me more determined to try to do my part to make the world a better place.
One tattoo at a time.
That kind world story from WBUR's Erica Lance. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
The first time I saw Star Wars was, I believe I saw it in my family's den, watching it with my dad and my brother on VHS, probably around 1994, 1995. I would have been in fifth or sixth grade at the time. And I was just transported by the aliens and the heroism. And there was one scene in particular, the famous binary sunset scene. And that's where you first hear... The second time, actually, you hear the Force theme, but the first time you hear it in a really exposed and full rendition in the key of G minor. There's no dialogue, it's just this very evocative imagery of the two suns approaching the horizon on Tatooine and Luke staring off into the distance. And there's something about that music, the harmony, the memorability of the theme that just grabbed me, and I was humming it in my head afterwards. And after that point, I knew I needed to know every second of this music. And ever since then, I've been just fascinated and, one might say, obsessed with this body of musical themes. And it's just been an important part of my life as a, you know, as a music lover and as a scholar.
This is one of the preeminent experts of the music of Star Wars.
Hi, my name is Frank Lehman. I am an assistant professor of music theory here at Tufts University, and I specialize in film music. I am the creator of the online catalog of Star Wars leitmotifs.
Lehman's catalog details every musical theme heard in the Star Wars scores, from the swing of the Cantina Band to Darth Vader's Imperial March. The score from the latest in the Star Wars series, The Last Jedi, is up for an Academy Award this Sunday. We recently sat down with Lehman at Tufts to talk about his relationship to the score and how composer John Williams adds another layer to the iconic film through music.
I love the Imperial March. I don't know that there's a more well-crafted and memorable and better representation of evil in music that I'm aware of. It made its first appearance in 1981 in The Empire Strikes Back as a kind of new theme for Darth Vader and the full forces of the Empire. In the original movie, there had actually just been a kind of dinky little motif for the Empire and Vader, which is nice, but it's not exactly something that you would go home whistling to yourself. But the Imperial March is the banner theme. It makes use of some interesting little musical techniques. It is a march, so there's very heavy percussion all the way through, sort of a snare line as though it's a procession. There's a healthy dose of what's called chromaticism, which is use of notes outside the standard major or minor scale, and that's how we get this very insinuating sounding progression here, which forms the basis of the first part of the Vader theme. It gets even crazier in the second half. It needs that chromaticism, it needs that perversion or little twist to make it so effective. Film composers are nothing if not master manipulators. They know tricks that have been well exploited over decades and sometimes even centuries to evoke certain emotional responses. And Williams certainly understands this. I mean, he's been doing it for 60 or so years now. So, for example, in the Luke and Leia theme, which you hear for the first time in Return of the Jedi, and then it goes silent until the very ending of The Last Jedi, it's quite ingenious. The melody, if you just hear it by itself, it's a long-breathed sort of tune, and the material is slightly familiar. Sort of rearrange the notes, change the rhythm a little bit. So there's a kind of secret relationship in this theme to the main theme or to Luke Skywalker's theme. They're sort of interchangeable. There's another theme that's kind of lurking in the background of the Luke and Leia sort of brother and sister theme. Back in episode 4, Williams introduces a leitmotif for Princess Leia. And while that melody itself doesn't play a great role in the Luke and Leia leitmotif, the harmony, the stuff that undergirds it, is basically verbatim in the Luke and Leia theme. So when Williams takes the Luke theme, slows it down, changes a few notes here and there, and combines it with the harmonies of the Leia theme, what you get is It's no exaggeration to say this is the sort of DNA that goes into the theme shared by the two characters. In The Last Jedi, we at long last see a reunion of two characters that have been separated for a very long time in cinema history, Luke Skywalker and Leia Organa. This is the dramatic low point of the film. It seems all is lost. Leia bemoans the fact that none of the allies to the Resistance have shown up, and then suddenly, magically, the hooded figure of Luke Skywalker appears, and Leia and Luke share a very tender moment of reunion. The music is, appropriately enough, Luke and Leia's theme. This is the first and only time it's heard in the score to The Last Jedi, and it's one of three times over the course of the entirety of this eight-movie franchise that it's heard. And it's, I believe, one of the most effective moments in the entire score. And this is called The Spark. This moment of connection between Luke and Leia is followed by maybe a requisite statement of another theme which is very, very closely associated with Leia, and that's the love theme between her and Han Solo. And we hear a quiet and pained version of their leitmotif, the Han and Leia love theme. So The Last Jedi is positively stuffed with leitmotifs. It may be the most self-consciously referential of all the Williams Star Wars movies. That said, there is some new and original thematic material that he composes for the film. The first, probably most prominent theme is one for the character of Rose, who's introduced in the movie. This is a very bright and optimistic musical idea that keeps on getting brighter and more optimistic the further into the theme you go. But it also seems to allude in some ways to previous themes established in the series for young characters or characters that are young at heart. So this very characteristic alternation of two chords, which Williams has previously associated with the character of Anakin Skywalker. He's also associated, probably most famously, with the character of Yoda. So even though the melody is novel, the backing of the theme, harmonically speaking, is something that Star Wars listeners have been accustomed to for the past seven or so movies. It's difficult when you know John Williams' film output as well as I do to not hear certain connections between various themes and cues and scores that he's written in the past. So Rose's theme, in addition to sort of resonating with Yoda's material and young Anakin's theme, also has a lot of the same sort of harmonic skeleton as a theme for E.T. I will not be crushed if John Williams does not win the Oscar for this, even though I think it's fully worthy of an Academy Award. That's because Williams has been nominated more times than I think anyone else living, and more times than anyone else living or dead besides Walt Disney. So he's certainly been honored enough. I've been listening to John Williams for a very long time, and there's a certain sense of ownership I have over his music that whenever there is a new score by John Williams, I'm extremely excited to seek it out and to hear what he's come up with. The man is 86 years old. It's amazing, still as active as he's ever been in Hollywood and on the concert stage. And every new score of his is like a gift in a way. So no one expected that he would do a prequel trilogy, let alone the sequel trilogy. So having the potential of 9 Star Wars scores is pretty incredible. And I consider myself very lucky that I'm not only able to study this as an academic, but simply as a fan.
Frank Lehman is an assistant professor of music theory at Tufts University. Our piece was produced by Allison Brusick and Tim Skog. That's our show for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna and Allison Brusack, with help from Zoe Mitchell, Lily Tyson, and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had help today from James Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.